Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, we'll remember the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He died this week at the age of 84. He was born in the Jim Crow South, but Chicago became his home. Jackson was a prominent figure for decades, whether it was civil rights, politics, or faith. He commanded attention. But there was more to Jackson than his public persona. We'll look back at his career. Also, 988, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, has proven successful, but some states support it more than others. We'll have a report. We'll also preview the candidates for the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate in Illinois and learn about efforts to expand ranked choice voting. We'll hear concerns from child care providers and parents as the future of federal subsidies remains uncertain. And the bald eagle has made an amazing comeback. We'll head out to an eagle watch party. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The civil rights activist, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, died this week. He was 84. A protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Jackson left an indelible mark on Chicago. Summer Van Benton has the story of his legacy in the city.
Jesse Jackson made the most of his life.
I am not a perfect servant. I am a public servant, doing my best against the odds.
Now, I can't get through all the details, but we have to talk about some of it. First, there's his arrival in Chicago. It was 1966. The Voting Rights Act had just passed the year before. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to address economic segregation in the nation's major cities. He tasked Jackson with leading those efforts in Chicago. Jackson was in his mid-20s when he arrived in the city of Big Shoulders. King organized a group of Chicago-based pastors to welcome him from the South. One of those pastors was Reverend Martin Deppe.
Well, Chicago is pretty sophisticated, and there were a lot of black leaders, and he was just another one of them. He didn't stand out right away. It took time.
Jackson's journey started in Operation Breadbasket. This movement was focused on improving economic conditions in black communities around the country. Under Jackson's leadership in Chicago, there was pressure for stores like Walgreens and Jewel Osco to hire more black workers, sell black-owned products, and improve the quality of food on their shelves. They were boycotting. They were having regular meetings. They were even knocking on the doors of CEOs. These businesses were losing money and were finally understanding the value of the black dollar.
We had a confidence, you see, in the 60s. There was an incredible sense of history changing before our eyes.
And then came the spring of 1968.
To be part of that movement was an incredible feeling. It's never come back to me. And it really ended when Dr. King was assassinated, and it was a strategic murder. I mean, it really ended a chapter in American history.
And then Jackson emerged. With King's assassination, Jackson stepped up, ushering him into another critical part of his legacy, especially here in Chicago. He continued those regular meetings on Saturday mornings. He wanted an open forum where people could learn about economic, social, and political advancements in the city. Jackson's longtime advisor, Reverend Jeanette Wilson, says all the stars would come. People like Oprah Winfrey, Aretha Franklin, and Al Sharpton would gather to hear from him.
I love to hear Reverend Jackson challenge us, economic justice, educational equity, and political empowerment.
Those meetings took place at what became the Rainbow Push Coalition headquarters on the corner of 50th and Drexel in Chicago's Kenwood neighborhood. Rainbow Push brought groups together that didn't always see eye to eye. From the Black Panther Party to the Urban League, Latino and Black communities, the LGBTQ community. Why? Well, here's a clip from his 1984 Democratic National Convention speech that explains.
America's more like a quilt. Many patches, many pieces, many colors, many sizes, all woven and held together by a common thread.
Now, let me be very clear. these meetings weren't just kumbaya sessions. They were opportunities for elected officials and politicians to address issues facing their communities. PUSH would continue to grow nationwide, but Jackson's leadership would enter a new phase. Starting in the 80s, Jackson made political strides himself and helped launch Black political careers from Chicago. Jackson was the first Black candidate since Shirley Chisholm who mounted a serious presidential campaign and advanced the idea that a Black candidate could become president one day. He first ran in 1984, and in his 1988 run, Jackson shocked the nation when he finished second in the national Democratic primaries.
America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. On tomorrow night and beyond. Keep hope alive. I love you very much.
He lost both bids, but his campaigns helped pave the way for Black leaders across the nation, particularly here in Chicago. Most notably, former President Barack Obama. In 2008, Jackson witnessed a Black man rise to the nation's highest office after his own attempts 2 decades before.
One of Barack Obama. It was the moment, the movement and the mission all came together.
There would be no end of the impact that Reverend Jesse Jackson has had on the development, the evolution of the Black presence in Chicago.
That's Congressman Danny Davis. He arrived in Chicago at the same time as Jackson, and they work closely together. He said Jackson's influence is everywhere. And even for those who aren't as directly familiar with his work, they may remember reciting I Am Somebody in grade school.
I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be unemployed, but I am somebody.
He recited it with children on Sesame Street in 1971.
Somebody. I may be young.
Here's him reciting it in 1972 before the Wattsex Music Festival.
Somebody. I am black, beautiful, proud. I must be respected. I must be protected.
Jackson used every moment of his life to advocate for others, to bring people together, to remind them that they had a voice.
He's a person that is called by God to a higher level of service. He's not just an ordinary preacher.
Summer Van Benton, WBEZ News.
Jackson's words shaped politics as a leader in the civil rights movement. Back in 2020, he sat down with Jen White and talked about his many speeches compiled in the book Keeping Hope Alive, Sermons and Speeches of the Reverend Jesse L. Jackson. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Reverend Jackson, what was it like for you to go back and reconsider these speeches and sermons that have been delivered around the world?
Frankly, I didn't want to do it.
Why?
Because often my speeches or sermons are spontaneous out of situations written to be heard, not to be written.
I am somebody.
And so this 84 and 88 speeches, many people requested them. We put those two speeches in the book.
You were born in South Carolina. You eventually came to Chicago to study at the Chicago Theological Seminary. And that was an interesting diversion for you because you were thinking about going to law school.
It was a tension between law school and seminary. And Dr. Samuel DeWitt Proctor was my president. He convinced me to try seminary out, and I got to seminary, and I found my voice. I was jailed in Greenville, South Carolina, with 7 other classmates in 1960. And then I met Dr. King at that time, and I went to Selma in 65, and we worked together until he was killed in 1968.
Speaking of civil rights, when you look back at the speeches and the sermons in the book, They span a range of issues, spiritual and political, domestic, international. But much of what you were speaking about, Reverend Jackson, are issues that are still top of mind today. Poverty, debt, voting rights, war, issues central to the current presidential election.
Those are timeless subjects.
Dream of peace. Peace is rational and reasonable. America must never surrender to malnutrition. We can feed the hungry and clothe the naked. We must never surrender to illiteracy. Invest in our children, never surrender and go forward. We must never surrender to inequality. Women cannot compromise ERA or comparable worth. Women are making 60 cents on the dollar to what a man makes. Women cannot buy meat cheaper. Women cannot buy bread cheaper. Women cannot buy milk cheaper. Women deserve to get paid for the work that you do.
Are you at all discouraged that these are issues we're still grappling with?
No, what sustains me during these difficult times is my faith, my belief. It's all but that light is coming, and it's not a train coming this way, it's sunshine, it's hope. And I look over my life in the last 60 years, I've seen so much progress, frankly. Sometimes sending some like talk about progress. I went to jail with 7 classmates trying to use a public library. It's beyond imagination that Texas to Florida to Maryland, we couldn't use a single public toilet. We couldn't buy ice cream at Howard Johnson. We couldn't rent a hotel room at Holiday Inn. We've come a long way. When I graduated from high school in Greenville, South Carolina, I couldn't apply to Clemson, University of Alabama, to play football. So I ended up going to University of Illinois to play football in the Big Ten. But when I see Clemson play Alabama in the big game, my heart rejoices, because I know to them it's not about skin color, it's about uniform color, about direction, not about complexion. Learning, we've survived apart, learning to live together is our challenge today.
Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking with Jen White. They talked in 2020. While Jackson is known for his civil rights leadership and political campaigns, he also carved a name for himself in pop culture. The Sun-Times columnist Lee Bay talked with Claire Lane about it.
Tell us a little bit about some of Jackson's biggest moments in pop culture.
Well, I think going back to the beginning, 1971, when he appears on Sesame Street and leads these group of kids right there on Sesame Street reciting I Am Somebody. And his appearances on Saturday Night Live are probably legendary, particularly when he reads Green Eggs and Ham in one 88 episode.
You do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them. Sam, I am.
You can hear the audience's laughter in that last clip. I'm smiling now. What made him so compelling to watch, even to listen to? We're getting that theater of the mind, even on the radio.
Well, certainly to listen to the cadence of his speech. I mean, obviously, being a reverend, there's the cadence of the black church in his speech, which is familiar to the American ear. And he's able to twist it, particularly with this skit. He doesn't overplay it. He hits it just right. I think generally, he was a tall, good-looking, charismatic man, and all of that helps as well. And he was able to leverage that into this while not compromising the real work that he's doing. I mean, he's freeing hostages. He's doing all, he's advocating for rights. And yet somehow, right alongside this, almost like one hand washing the other, he's able to have this other identity that doesn't compromise, and they don't compromise each other in any way, which is quite the strike, quite the note to hit.
And for such a serious man doing serious work, a man of the people, certainly, he was able to laugh at himself.
Yeah, he does. I mean, there's one Saturday Night Live skit. I think it's with Billy Crystal, who's imitating Sammy Davis Jr. And somehow along the way in this skit, he sings this song called Rubber Ball, Red Rubber Ball. And he can't sing, but he's kind of having fun with it, singing along with Billy Crystal. I mean, many people probably would be too uptight to do that. And he was down with the joke.
And he wasn't afraid to be on stage, to be in the spotlight. Why do you think it was important for Reverend Jackson to participate in pop culture, to show up at places like SNL?
I think it helps the real work of civil rights. And I think that the ability to appeal to these audiences ends up helping the work. In fact, there's one, you know, there's one Saturday Night Live skit that I couldn't find the video of for the piece, but he's a game show host. I think this is in 84 because he's lost the Democratic primary. You know, Reagan is, you know, going on to be elected. And it's a game show like Jeopardy. So he would ask, who's on the $100 bill or something like that? And then he would answer his own question. He would say the question is moot. With Reagan in the office, most Americans haven't even seen a $100 bill. I mean, so and he goes into this diatribe, which is funny but true, about the challenges that Americans face, and every question is like this. So there, it's funny. It's very funny, actually, but it's also hitting the very messages he would hit if he were on the, you know, on the speaking circuit talking about real American issues, Black American issues especially.
And he certainly could deliver a punchline very quickly. Anyone else politically who can have the same cultural impact as the Reverend?
You know, I think President Barack Obama comes the closest. He's very funny, very funny. But I think beyond that, you know, back in the, you know, a few years ago, John McCain on a good day could be, but nothing like Barack Obama, and certainly nothing like Reverend Jackson.
That's columnist Lee Bay talking with Claire Lane. Jackson founded what became the Rainbow Push Coalition in the Bronzeville neighborhood of Chicago. And Brandon Kondritz walked that neighborhood this week to hear what residents see as Jackson's legacy.
I remember when Obama won, and I remember the tears in his eyes and how proud he was.
He was a legend, that's all I can say, man. I grew up looking at him on TV, so it's heartbreaking.
It didn't matter what color you was. He fought for everybody. For rights, civil rights.
It's important that we understand and remember the struggle that our people went through here in Chicago and all around the world. Like Jesse Jackson walked the streets with Martin Luther King.
Keep hope alive. That's all I remember. Keep hope alive for everybody.
Passion Terrell, Kevin Smith, Beverly Fagan, Chloe Gold, and Tamari Stevens. Thanks to Brandon Kondritz for that report. The Reverend Jesse Jackson died this week. He was 84. This is Statewide. And welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Mental health hotlines can be especially valuable in rural areas where there may not be any therapists or social workers close by. That includes 988, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. It launched less than 4 years ago and has already responded to nearly 20 million contacts. But support for 988 is stronger in some states than in others. Michael Marks has more.
The 988 system was designed to give people in crisis an easy-to-remember number that's available 24 hours a day. Every state has its own set of call centers with trained operators, and since the hotline started taking calls in 2022, demand has increased nationwide.
We have been seeing a month-over-month increase in utilization of 988, and so we are also working pretty hard to keep up.
That's Monica Kurz, Chief Administrative Officer for HealthSource Integrated Solutions in Kansas, one of the state's 988 call centers. She says the service is a necessity for rural Kansans.
We know that in our rural and frontier counties in Kansas, folks might be traveling hours to get to their nearest mental health clinic. And this is a way to access services right away without that kind of distance barrier.
Responding quickly is essential. A caller frustrated with a long wait time might hang up. Plus, if they spend 2 minutes on hold, the call is rerouted from a local facility to a national backup center. A backup operator may not be able to connect someone with local resources, says Lauren Moyer, chair of Missouri's 988 Task Force.
If someone is really struggling with substance use and needs connected to a residential substance use bed in the moment, somebody from another state is not going to have access to that information.
When the 988 hotline launched, the federal government paid for it, but states were expected to pick up the tab eventually. That has not happened in Texas yet. Jennifer Battle is vice president of the Harris Center in Houston, which fields 988 calls. During a legislative hearing last year, she said the state's call centers get around 200,000 calls annually, and the state needs to step up and help fund the program.
As impressive as these numbers are that we're able to serve with the current federal funds, these funds only allow for us to be able to answer on average 84% of the 988 calls that originate in Texas.
The federal 988 bill recommended that states pay for the program through fees on telecommunication products. That's how 911 is largely funded. Only a dozen have done so, including Minnesota and Illinois. But in Missouri, they're doing things a little differently, dedicating money from the state's general fund each year. Lauren Moyer, the Missouri State Task Force chair, worries about sustainability.
You know, general revenue support, it's its own line item, and that's not guaranteed long term.
Oklahoma doesn't have a recurring fee to support 988 either. According to State Representative Kevin Norwood, a Republican from the Tulsa area, there's little appetite in the state legislature for a new tax.
Before I became a legislator, that idea was introduced and it gained no traction.
Norwood is now sponsoring a bill that would create a trust fund for 988, which would ensure the money is only used for the hotline.
When I jumped into it, I was like, okay, we need to make it where it's not just a short-term fix, that it would be long-term and sustainable.
Texas has followed a similar path. Lawmakers there have been unable to pass the telecommunications fee through the legislature. In 2025, Texas established a trust fund, but the balance is currently zero. Jonathan Pertle studies 988 funding at the New York University School of Global Public Health.
Those trust funds are a strategy, but if there's not funds in the trust fund, it's not going to have that much of an impact. But it's something that some states are trying. It's a signal of effort, I suppose.
Pertle is near the end of a five-year study. He's analyzing the funding of 988 systems in all 50 states. So far, he's found that those with long-term dedicated funding for staff are generally more efficient.
The big thing is people, right? The staffing, the people to work in these call centers is the main thing.
He may have a new data point in the near future. Missouri's legislature is set to consider a 988 funding fee later this year. I'm Michael Marks, Harvest Public Media.
Over the past year, the Trump administration has terminated multiple grants, together worth over $10 million, that were supposed to help schools in Illinois hire more mental health professionals. Peter Medlin reports on how terminations are affecting schools in northern Illinois.
It's 2 a.m., and Mallory Bain-Benassi is on her computer searching for solutions. She's the executive director of the Bureau Marshall Putnam Special Education Cooperative. Her special ed teachers work in 14 rural school districts across those three counties. She can't find enough school psychologists, and the need increases every year. They've offered signing bonuses, but still couldn't compete with the suburbs. They've hired remote psychs, but they can't do everything, and now that pool's drying up too.
The shortage is real. It is real, and it is scary, and it is stressful.
The National Association of School Psychologists recommends one school psych per 500 students. At Bain-Benassi's co-op, it's nearly 1,000.
The only thing that my school psychs currently have time to do is the very tip of the iceberg. The whole bottom of that iceberg is the mental health stuff. All of the things that they really went to school to do, they can't do.
Luckily, that night, she found a new grant that the U.S. Department of Education awarded Northern Illinois University. It's a multi-year program that pays teachers already working in the district to become school psychologists. So she signed up for the program. They now have two students in it and could have five new homegrown school psychs within the next few years. But last year, the Trump administration canceled the grant. Illinois and other states have filed a federal lawsuit to retain its more than $2 million of funding.
The most recent information I heard was that the federal judge had said that the Department of Education had improperly stopped those funds.
That's Lisa Becker. She's a former school psychologist and now works as an administrator in the DeKalb School District. DeKalb is also part of the NIU grant. And she says that right now, the university's guaranteed funding for students to finish up the semester, but beyond that, they don't know if it'll continue. And right now, DeKalb has three school psych interns.
We recently had a death of a staff member in schools, and it impacted our early learning and development center. And our intern has been able to provide so much support.
That intern, Adrian Fell, has been an early childhood teacher for the past dozen years in DeKalb.
We at the Pre-K Early Childhood Center have never had a full-time school psychologist, and being a teacher here, I've noticed a need, those SEL supports.
Bain Benassi at the Special Ed Co-op prays the grant can continue because she's just about out of options.
I mean, nothing's worked. This was honestly like the only light at the end of our tunnel. Because if there was a different light, right, if something else was already going to work for us, it would have already happened.
That NIU program is not the only school mental health grant the Trump administration terminated. They also canceled two grants for the Illinois State Board of Education to recruit and support more school mental health professionals. For both grants, the state partnered with the Stress and Trauma Treatment Center. They're a mental health provider in Southern Illinois that provides training to schools all across the state. Matt Buckman is the executive director, and he says the state helped them work with 61 high-need districts in Illinois. And in the program's first year, 26 of those districts hired more school mental health staff. They could provide a $25,000 salary stipend for high-need schools. But now, with the termination, districts that planned to expand were caught in a bind, unsure if the money would be there. Buckman says many of those expansions fell through.
I only know of one district that actually ended up hiring somebody, knowing there weren't these funds.
Thousands of school mental health grants were cut, but some weren't. Buckman says he thinks theirs was because it prioritized diversity. In December, a federal judge ruled that the cancellations were unlawful and ordered the funding be permanently reinstated. So far, spokespeople for the Illinois State Board of Education say they haven't heard anything yet. Either way, Buckman says he's proud of their work.
There were thousands of kids across the state that received services that didn't receive it the year prior. That's a huge thing.
I'm Peter Medlin.
2026 has been rocky for child care providers in five Democratic-led states, including here in Illinois. They're struggling with the uncertainty of what has been a promise of federal funding. Andrea Hsu reports.
You need to learn how to say Baba.
It's 8 in the morning, drop-off time at Michelle's Place, a child care center in Granite City, Illinois, on the Mississippi River. A mom apologizes for handing over a baby with a soiled diaper. It happened in the car.
Always change it before I leave.
No worries.
The staff cheerfully step in. They know mom's got to get to work.
Yeah, it's okay, we know.
That's the owner of Michelle's Place, Michelle Wright. She says these parents are hardworking people.
We have people that work in the gas stations, clinics, the local clinics, the grocery stores. We have a couple of clerks from there.
Also, fast food workers, car wash attendants, people who don't make a lot of money. In fact, 90% of the children at Michelle's Place qualify for child care subsidies, paid for by the state with funds from the federal government. So when news broke that Illinois' child care funds were being frozen, parents panicked.
All of a sudden, I'm hearing parents say, hey, are you going to close? I'm like, Chloe, were you going to take my kid? I'm like, yes, what is going on?
What was going on was that allegations of child care fraud had erupted in Minnesota, more than 500 miles away. In response, the Trump administration announced it was freezing funds for several programs that help low-income families, not just in Minnesota, but also California, Colorado, New York, and Illinois. The administration said it needed to review how the money's being spent. The state sued, arguing this wasn't about fraud, that they were being targeted for political reasons. A court has blocked the freeze for now, but the legal fight continues. And Michelle Wright is clear-eyed about what a funding freeze would mean for her.
If it freezes and freezes too long, yes, we would close.
And not just this center, but another one she owns half an hour away. Nearly her entire budget depends on those subsidy payments.
There'd be 78 children right now that will immediately lose care. And there's nowhere to refer them, nowhere to send them. I don't know where they would end up.
Before she opened in Granite City, Wright says there was no infant care nearby. It's why she chose the spot. She could have opened a daycare in an affluent community instead, where families don't rely on subsidies, where she could have charged more for each child in her care. But she believes it's her calling to serve those in need. She once relied on child care subsidies herself.
Years ago, my first child, so I know the struggle.
And it's not just families who depend on Wright. Between her two centers, she employs 21 people. She says already they don't earn enough. Many rely on public assistance themselves. And now she fears the added uncertainty will drive them away.
They have to be able to earn their living as well.
Now, over in the toddler room, Summer Scanina is hugging her 3-year-old goodbye.
I love you.
Get muffin.
Okay, go eat your muffins.
It's an easy drop-off, no tears.
She loves it. She loves her friends. She loves the teachers. She talks about them at nighttime. She prays for them at night.
Scanina cleans houses for a living. She is grateful to have reliable childcare and help paying for it.
If I didn't have daycare, I wouldn't make money. I wouldn't pay my bills.
And now with another baby on the way, she is counting on Michelle Wright to stay open.
I wouldn't send her nowhere else. I'm so scared.
And Wright wants to stay open.
It's nothing I would rather do.
But in this political climate, she knows nothing is a given. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Granite City, Illinois.
As voters start casting ballots for the spring primary, several Illinois communities are trying to implement ranked choice voting. But confusion about election law has slowed implementation. Evan Holden brings us more.
Ranked choice voting allows people to rank candidates in the order they most want them. If no candidate gets 50% of the vote, then the lowest candidate is dropped and their supporters' votes go to their second choice. This is repeated until one candidate gets 50% of the vote. Supporters of ranked choice voting say it forces candidates to seek broader appeal. It's intended to weed out polarizing candidates. Voters in Evanston, north of Chicago, passed a referendum in 2022 to implement ranked choice voting, but the Cook County Clerk, which oversees elections in Evanston, said current election laws only allow for a person to vote for one candidate. The nonpartisan Good Government Group, Reform for Illinois, and the City of Evanston sued, but are still waiting for the case to be heard. Dan Ashurst is executive director of Fair Vote Illinois, a group that supports ranked choice voting. He says they are looking to give state guidelines on how to implement ranked choice voting at the local level.
They need the State Board of Elections to come in and give them standards on how to administer a ranked choice voting election and make sure that there is state level leadership of how to technically implement it.
Ashurst supports a bill Illinois lawmakers have introduced, making it clear that local governments can implement ranked choice voting if they choose, while its legality is being challenged in court. Ashurst says the current system encourages voting for the candidate they believe has the best chance of winning, rather than the candidates they think are the best for the issues they care about most.
Voting and democracy is core to our political system. It affects all other issues that we think about, whether it's whatever you care about, if it's immigration, it's healthcare, it's housing, it's affordability.
Efforts at the state level to implement ranked choice voting have failed, and the bill has not been called for a vote. Republican State Senator Chris Balkema, who represents a large rural area between Bloomington Normal and Interstate 80, ran a survey asking his constituents how they felt about ranked choice voting. 83% of respondents opposed ranked choice voting. Balkema says new voting systems would create confusion.
We have a wonderful election system that's been functioning well for multiple centuries, and to inject this caveat into it is not seen as needed by the majority of my district.
Democratic State Senator Dave Kaler, who represents parts of Peoria and Bloomington Normal, says he supports ranked choice voting because it makes candidates appeal to a broader range of voters.
From what I have seen, it tends to lessen the nasty rhetoric that you sometimes see in elections, because people are now not only asking for your vote, they're asking for your second place vote.
Kaler says ranked choice voting has been successfully implemented in states like Maine and is starting to become a trend in cities. But he says it won't be a priority for him in the spring session. Republican State Senator Sally Turner previously ran elections in Logan County as its county clerk. Turner says she opposes ranked choice voting for financial reasons.
Local counties don't have the money to implement ranked choice voting, nor does the state have any money to give to local governments to help them figure out how to do ranked choice voting.
Turner says ranked choice voting could work on a local level, but it should be up to local governments to decide. Peoria passed a non-binding referendum in 2024 to research ranked choice voting, but currently has no plans to implement it. Chris Kiergaard, president of the League of Women Voters in Greater Peoria, says the League supports ranked choice voting because it minimizes wasted votes and should increase voter turnout.
It encourages more people to get into races, allowing a wider spectrum of choice for voters. And if you know that you have ranked choice voting, you may become a viable candidate when you wouldn't have been one before.
I'm Evan Holden.
This is Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. On February 18, 1930, Clyde Tombaugh of Streeter, Illinois, discovered our solar system's most famous dwarf planet, Pluto. Pluto was the first planet discovered in the 20th century and the only planet ever discovered by an American. Clyde Tombaugh was born to farmers in Streeter, Illinois, on February 4, 1906. At 16, his family moved to Kansas. At 20, he built the first of many homemade telescopes and sent drawings of his observations to the Lowell Observatory at Flagstaff, Arizona. At 23, the observatory hired him. Lowell Observatory was founded by Percival Lowell, a mathematician and astronomer who believed there was a ninth planet, Planet X, hiding beyond Neptune. He died before Tombaugh came to the observatory, but Tombaugh took up his quest. Tombaugh photographed the night sky and compared images to search for moving objects. He confirmed his discovery of a new planet on February 18, 1930. He had been at the observatory less than a year. Tombaugh's discovery was a media sensation. It was named Pluto after the Greek god of the cold, dark underworld. Pluto's reign as our tiniest planet ended in 2006 when the International Astronomical Union downgraded it to a dwarf planet, one of many in our solar system's outer regions. In 2015, the New Horizons space probe passed Pluto and discovered a heart-shaped region on its surface. That heart is officially named the Tombaugh Regio. I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
You're listening to Statewide. Illinois residents soon have a big choice to make. Who should represent them in the U.S. Senate for the next 6 years? And because Illinois is such a heavily blue state, all eyes are on the Democratic Party in the race to replace the longtime retiring U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. The three leading candidates, two congresspeople, and the state's lieutenant governor, have each spent years in elected office themselves. Mawa Iqbal and Mariah Wolfel have more on who they are and what they're promising. Mawa starts us off.
It's debate night at the University of Chicago's International House, the first time all three candidates shared a debate stage. They're all wearing blue and shuffling through pages of notes before the program gets underway. And once it does, it becomes clear that these three opponents all share a common enemy.
The chaos of Donald Trump.
Under Donald Trump.
Stand up to Donald Trump.
It's a crowded Democratic primary field in the race to replace Durbin, as the party grapples with how to respond to Trump. And each of the three leading candidates say their upbringing and background makes them the best person for the job. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy was born in India and moved to America, where his family relied on food stamps and public housing, before his dad landed a stable job in Peoria, Illinois.
And they made it into the middle class. And pretty much every night at the dinner table, my father would say, think of the greatness of this country. Think of the greatness of this country, and whatever the two of you do, my brother and me, make sure it's there for the next families who need it.
Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton ran for a seat in the Illinois State House after caring for her mother, Velma, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
At that time, I was watching the news and I saw that my state representative was working to strip away health care from seniors like my mother. And I got angry and yelled at the television, somebody should run against him. And I didn't know it was me, but it turned out it was me.
Congresswoman Robin Kelly says she got her strong work ethic from her parents.
I'm the daughter of a postal worker and a grocer. I'm a mom and I'm a dedicated public servant. And I'm running for U.S. Senate to make your life better and make your life more affordable.
These Democrats all share similar policy blueprints. Kelly and Stratton both want to expand Medicare, while Krishnamoorthy and Kelly seek to lower child care costs, a policy Stratton is also behind. But there are some nuanced differences between them. Here's Mariah.
Take, for instance, these candidates' stance on federal immigration enforcement agencies. Kelly is pushing a resolution to impeach Homeland Security head Kristi Noem. The Congresswoman and Krishnamoorthy both want to dismantle and reform Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, but think it's unrealistic to call for total abolition. Here they are in interviews with WBEZ.
Nice, catchy slogans are one thing, but we still need some type of enforcement.
ICE does perform certain enforcement mechanisms with regard to combating child and human
sex trafficking, combating fentanyl smuggling. But on the other hand, we need to completely revamp the way that it's run.
Stratton is trying to push it one step further.
I don't see any way that we can reform this agency, retrain people to be better than what we're seeing.
Stratton has portrayed herself as the progressive outsider alternative to her two counterparts, who have each spent at least a decade in Congress.
I'm distinguishing myself as the new guard versus the old guard.
But Stratton herself is a Democratic Party stalwart, having served in the state legislature and then two terms with Governor J.B. Pritzker. And Pritzker has a lot riding on this race. He funneled $5 million into a super PAC supporting Stratton's campaign.
Juliana has the compassion and passion to fight for the working families of Illinois.
Krishnamoorthy, meanwhile, has way outraised his opponents. He pointed to his private sector business background and says he defies labels, except for this one.
I call myself a radical common sense prosperity Democrat. We have to return to our DNA as the party of economic opportunity.
Kelly calls herself a workhorse, not a show horse.
I think I have formed really good relationships. I work well on both sides of the aisle.
On the campaign trail, Kelly has emphasized her support for a progressive-led effort to block weapon sales to Israel amid the war in Gaza, a measure Krishnamoorthy has not signed on to. And Kelly recently differentiated herself on the debate stage by becoming the only candidate to say she agrees with human rights organizations that accuse Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. It's a cause that Senator Durbin has recently been vocal about, being the first U.S. senator to call for a ceasefire in Gaza after the 2023 attack by Hamas.
Durbin says looking at the field, all three candidates are well qualified, but he doesn't plan to endorse anyone.
But I look at this and think these three nominees have the wherewithal to get their own message out and a background, a good story to tell about their public service. So let the voters make the final decision.
Durbin is the number two Democrat in the Senate. He's occupied his seat for nearly 30 years. His predecessor, Democrat Paul Simon, had, like Stratton, previously served as lieutenant governor in the 60s. The last time a U.S. Senate seat was wide open in Illinois was in 2011, when Republican Mark Kirk narrowly beat then-state treasurer Alexei Janulius, a Democrat. Candidates to replace Durbin say they appreciate his commitment to constituent services and want to carry on that legacy. But they're also pitching voters on what they'd change.
Stratton says she won't give an inch to Trump, like not supporting Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who some voters say is too tepid. Krishnamoorthy says he'll invest more in emerging technologies, like AI and quantum computing, while Kelly says she'll continue advocating for issues affecting Black women and girls, such as maternal mortality. But ultimately, Durbin has some advice for whoever his successor becomes. Be prepared to legislate in a dark period of the country, when even the truth is up for debate.
I don't know where the president, Donald Trump, is going with his historic revisionism, but it clearly is part of his agenda. He wants to rewrite American history the way he wants it remembered, instead of following the facts.
There are seven other Democrats in the primary, including Steve Botsford Jr., who had about $130,000 in his political fund at the end of 2025. None of the others have anything close to that cash on hand, and none are or have been office holders. Whoever wins this Democratic primary race will face the winner of the six-way Republican primary in November. I'm Mariah Wolfel.
I'm Mawa Iqbal.
I'm reporter Araceli Gomez-Saldana with voting info ahead of the March 17th primary election. Here's what you should know if you're voting for the first time in Illinois. The first step is to register. You'll need to show two IDs, at least one with your current address. Students can use a high school or college ID, and you can register in person at any early voting location or on Election Day. You must be a U.S. citizen and at least 17 years old. That's right, 17-year-olds can vote in the primary as long as they turn 18 on or before the general election on November 3rd. Kiara Hardin is with Chicago Votes, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement. She recommends first-time voters look for voter guides.
And essentially what a voter guide does, or what it is, it provides a list of all of the people who, all of the candidates who are going to be on the ballot and the things in which they care about. So we ask them different questions and answer those questions within there so that you can see if it is in alignment with like you as an individual.
Once you're read up, you have three options to cast your ballot: by mail, during in-person early voting, or on Election Day. Out-of-state college students can request a mail-in ballot by contacting their local election authority. or if a student has lived in Illinois for 30 days, they can register to vote here. I'm Araceli Gomez Aldana.
Governor J.B. Pritzker this week unveiled a $56 billion spending plan amid funding uncertainty from the Trump administration. Pritzker's office's $2 billion in federal funds are on the line, and Trump's big tax plan means $500 million in lost revenue for the state.
Seven times now, I have promised to propose and sign a balanced budget. And seven times I have delivered on that promise. This year will be no different, despite how challenging this eighth year's budget is.
The state budget proposal hones in on funding K through 12 schools and paying down Illinois' unfunded pension systems. Pritzker's also zeroing in on cost of living. He's calling for the construction of more affordable housing and credits to help residents pay their utility bills, among many other things. Senator Jill Tracy of Quincy serves as Republican whip. She says Pritzker's proposals to address affordability, like reducing utility costs, may be too late.
It's something we've been talking about for a very long time, is affordability for Illinoisans. Why people leave the state is because it's not affordable.
The Illinois General Assembly has until the end of May to negotiate next year's budget. The bald eagle used to be a rare sight in Illinois, but now there are more than 3,000 that spend the winter here. It's a conservation success story. Jess Savage attended a recent eagle watch party, and she brings us more details.
It's a cold, quiet Saturday in February, and a couple dozen people are gathered by the open water behind McHenry Dam on the Fox River. They huddle together, bundled up in the parking lot. A few stoop behind spotting scopes, basically long-range telescopes set up on a tripod. A few are trained on a huge nest up in a tree on the other side of the river. They're looking for eagles.
But I see them. Oh my gosh. I know where they are now. How exciting.
Suzanne Peterson loves bird watching, and the scopes are much more powerful than binoculars alone.
Get to see eagles up close and personal, because we don't have this type of equipment. We would see a spot in the sky.
This gathering is part of an eagle watching series the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, McHenry County Audubon, and other conservation groups host. The eagles are easier to see before the trees leaf out. There are eagle watching events throughout the state, but because the nest is so visible from this vantage point, people tend to get pretty lucky. Stacy Iwanicki is with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources.
But they'll come to where they can find the open water, which when the river freezes generally is just on the downstream side of dams, which is what makes McHenry Dam such a great location.
Seeing these creatures would have been nearly impossible a few decades ago. Bald eagle populations were almost non-existent in Illinois in the 1970s. It's because of the widespread use of DDT, a pesticide that built up in the fish that eagles ate. It thinned their eggshells, which decimated the reproduction of eagles. DDT was banned in 1972, and soon after, the DNR and the Audubon Society started protecting habitat for the birds. In the late 70s, there was just one nest found in Illinois. Now, bald eagle nests are found in most counties in the state. Iwanicki again.
It was humans realizing there was a problem, understanding what that problem was, and knowing there was a solution, and coming together and agreeing to make the solution happen.
It's a good day for birders. Iwanicki sees some ducks splashing around in the open water.
I am looking at common golden eyes and redheads. There's two redheads. They're kind of self-explanatory. Their heads are very red.
And the eagles usually like to stir up the Canada geese as well.
Seldom do they ever catch one of the geese, but it gets their attention, and the whole raft of geese will just float up all at once. It has not happened yet today, but it's impressive when it does. The sound of the wings, the honking.
Jim Bohm is on the board of directors at the Friends of Moraine Hills State Park. He says events like this are special because they get people outside and away from their screens.
How much it means to the people to be able to come to a place where you have some quiet and you can see other animals, whether it's the birds or beavers, turtles, snakes, all these things, and to be able to see that instead of being constantly in an artificial world.
Suzanne Peterson has been coming to these eagle watching events for the past few years.
It's just the grandiosity of nature. It's just so, they're just so beautiful. And I mean, I get excited over the geese, too. So
the event is simple. Show up, observe, and maybe meet another enthusiast. But there's something deeper, says Iwanicki.
You know, nature's a great equalizer. We can all come together regardless of what the rest of our life looks like and just enjoy nature. And bald eagles are like a gateway to understanding nature in a broader scale.
Nesting season is underway. Pairs will take turns incubating their eggs, which usually hatch in March and April. That means eaglets may be visible at the dam in the coming months. From McHenry Dam, I'm Jess Savage.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us. And don't forget to join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.